So, Rebecca, I have an email from a patron that I want you to comment on because I think you might have a few things to say about it. What do you say?
Okay, no pressure.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Rebecca?
I'm Rebecca Bloom. I used to be a professor, and now I'm in full-time private practice working with adults who are motivated for treatment in South Seattle.
Yeah, it's funny. I was looking for a relative because I've been doing all this genealogy, like we were talking about, and I searched my pictures for a distant relative named Rebecca, and your picture came up,
Oh.
and there was you and me being bored in a faculty assembly meeting, if you remember
Oh,
that,
God.
in 2009. You and I are just staring into the darkness as like someone is, talking about some nonsense. But anyway, patron Elizabeth wrote in and she says, I wanted to comment on a discussion you had on an episode regarding how parents should be reinforcing their kids' behavior with love and attention rather than food and material goods. In my field, we often work to pair material items or food with positive attention as a
She an
means.
animal trainer?
As a means to eventually fade out the material items and allow the social attention to become reinforcing. As I work with children with special needs, they often do not inherently possess that ability to appreciate attention as a reinforcer. So we need to create that association between their preferred items, like food and, material items, and their non-preferred form of reinforcement. I'm wondering your thoughts on this, as it seems you believe that children are inherently born with an ability to appreciate social reinforcement, and parents undo this natural reinforcer by reinforcing with material goods and food. Is this the case? Or do you think that social reinforcement is something that is learned? Rebecca, what do you think?
Well, I have worked in a token economy on the psych unit. Have you ever worked in a setting like that?
Me, no, but I
Okay.
am familiar with token economies, yeah.
So people would get points for attending groups, and then at the end of the week, they could turn those points in for hygiene items. So I am very familiar with, and this was with adults. And the idea was that these people didn't have the skills enough to do that. I mean, I think it's all about level of functioning. Like, we make these blanket statements like children or adults, but really, I think the nuanced level of functioning is really important. So, if somebody is extremely low functioning and interpersonal relationship doesn't register for them, yes, you need to find a different way of connecting.
Like with food.
I mean, potentially, every parent I know has bribed their child for potty training, unless they're one of those diaper-free parents that has time for all that, with M&Ms. So, who am I to say, like, don't do that when, it works and people are at the end of their rope and they need something.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I would be lying if I said that
Don't.
doesn't.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah, what I'll say about this is similar to what you're saying, or the same, but just in a different way, which is that, yeah, it's a very complicated topic. It's in the field of what we call learning theory or behavioral therapy. Material items and food are absolutely effective as reinforcers and as motivators. I mean, all you have to do is look at animal. You said, was this person animal trainer? I mean, we are not that different from our other mammal cousins. And all you got to do, I was in Universal recently, and I've been to SeaWorld too, and you just realize that the trainers use food all the time. They have this little bag of little pellets, that they just give the animals whenever they do what they're told to do because they just want to reinforce it. And you just realize, wow, food is a pretty big motivator, and it can be used to train people that you're trying to train. It's usually in the context of children, right? You're usually trying to train or shape the behavior of children. And yeah, for people working with special needs kids, food and material items are sometimes the only thing that will work, as you're saying. But also, as patron Elizabeth is pointing out, it's important to periodically review your reward system, whether you're a clinician or a parent, and think about your overall approach to rewarding a child, you know, or someone else that you're trying to change their behavior. Because if your dominant way of reinforcing behavior is with food or material items, and you're not trying to incorporate what we call, you know, social reinforcers, like smiling and praise and, you know, like tokens, earning stars, things that don't involve food and spending money. You know, if you don't periodically review that, you run the risk of kind of creating a monster, essentially. You know, if everything you did as a young person was rewarded with an M&M, you know, what happens when you don't get that M&M anymore?
Well, you only save it for potty training. I mean, the most important.
Right. Right. So imagine if everything you did, you know, every time they went to bed on time, or every time they stopped yelling at you, or every time they sat quietly, or, you know, if everything you did was with M&Ms, that would create an expectation and a neural pathway, perhaps, that you don't want to have. You want really the person, the human being, to respond to social cues, because that's how the real world works. When you show up to work on time, your boss doesn't give you an M&M.
You know? I wish they did, because I'm my own boss.
Yeah. So. And yeah, well, you can. I think that's what we just learned.
I need to talk to my boss.
Yeah, you're just kind of a jerk of a boss, is what we just learned in that situation. But also, when you do that, research shows you increase the likelihood of someone becoming obese, especially with kids, right? If every little thing you do is associated with, you know, especially a sugary item, then it creates a pattern behavior in which they will reward everything they do with something sugary. And so, but again, I have to go back to, if you're working in a classroom of 20 special needs kids, and you're just trying to get through the day, and you're trying to, you know, keep people from hurting each other, and food or, you know, M&Ms are the only thing that work, then by all means, go for it, really. So, you know, that's what, but the overall hope is that you can, as Patron Elizabeth is saying, you can start pairing these social reinforcers with these food and material items, so that eventually you can kind of wean them off of the material items and the food, and only provide the social reinforcements like praise and that sort of thing. And I've seen that before. In my limited work with special needs kids, I remember doing that. And it's hard work, you know, because...
Oh, it's the hardest work.
Yeah, I mean, some of these people, they need constant oversight and constant direction and constant, hey, you know, no, hey, no, that, oh, if you do, hey, you know, you can never relax. And mm-hmm. So I'm guessing what Patron Elizabeth is reacting to is, I flippantly said in some other episode, like, you should never use food as a reinforcer. I probably wouldn't have said that, but something along those lines. I probably intimated something like that. And the issue is much more complicated than that. And well, using food isn't bad. It's just, you just really just have to think about your approach overall.
So I have a slightly different example, which I'm finding really fascinating these days. So, it's the way that technology is hitting those same receptors, the same pleasure receptors that food hits.
Yeah.
So my son just had his bar mitzvah.
Yeah.
And someone who doesn't have a child gave him as a gift Alexa, the Amazon response device. I don't even know what to call it. It's like if the internet was just audio, and it responded to your voice.
Right.
And it's fascinating to watch him with it, because everything he wants, he can just ask it for it. And most of it he gets immediately.
Yeah.
So anything
What does he ask for?
Hip hop radio. And there's a 24-hour a day This American Life show.
Oh, wow. Well, I mean,
could be worse.
Yeah. I was thinking like porn or something, or I don't know. Just trying to think of what else a 13-year-old would.
Yeah. He just wants to hear stories about people.
Yeah.
But it made me think about like the experience that this generation is having is so different. I mean, when I was a kid, you had to wait for that thing that you wanted to show up, in the mail or whatever. But now that he just gets it instantly, and when he doesn't get it instantly, he kind of freaks out.
Well, I think I'm the same way. We grew up in the same time. We're the same age. And, I'm the same way. It's like when it's so funny too, cause it's like you're saying, when we were younger, I mean, you're saying you had to wait, but really 99% of the things that I have access to now, I would never have been able to get, simple things like weather patterns. I remember I'd have to go to like my uncle's house and like peruse through his old almanacs. Remember those things?
Oh, of course. Yes.
You know, and it's like all this plethora of information. You kind of flip through. It felt like it's like, oh my God, data, you know, it's like in here. And, but yeah, I'm totally that way. But as a mom, how does that affect things? Is it a bad thing? You know?
Well, to tell him that he doesn't have access to it is like the end of the world. So, you know, as technology gets added in, there's all these other next levels. So we were discovering that he was waking up in the middle of the night and turning the hip-hop station back on when we were asleep. So then we had to buy this other device called the Circle. Have you heard about this?
No.
Okay, so it's from Disney, and it's a second router where you can put all of the kids' devices on that router and put time limits on it. Because trying to run around after your child, trying to get the device out of their hands, gets a little exhausting after a while. And so it's fascinating that Disney has come out with this device that you tell it, basically. So we tell it to turn Alexa off at 10:30 and not turn her back on until 7 the next day. Because it's the monitoring becomes this whole like second level of exhaustion for parents. And it was fascinating when I posted this on Facebook, everybody wrote back like, oh my God, what are you doing? Because I just can't take it anymore. And I mean, at this point, all of us have a device in every room and your kid is smart enough to figure out how to get on every single one of them.
Oh, totally.
They watch your passcode. So it's been interesting to have this other device in the house that controls his time.
Yeah.
And it's taken the arguments out of it because, you know, there is no motivation greater than that device, which just feeds that pleasure center of his brain.
Right.
And I'm kind of glad I'm a therapist and that I know that, because otherwise I would just think like my son is an addict jerk. But, you know, I know that he can't disengage because the whole device is created so he won't stop engaging.
Right.
And that's not his fault.
Yeah.
But at some point, you know, he has to stop listening to the current hip hop music. He did tell me, this was an amazing parenting moment. He instructed me that rap stands for rhythm and poetry, and not every person is good at both. Some people are just good at one or the other. And I was like, I feel like the true information of the world has been passed down to him now that he's educating me on hip hop and how it works.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you wanted to be a really kind of hip parent, you could have responded in a rap.
I'm not that fast.
Hey son, you just taught me about something. Oh. You know, you could have really gone, you know, if you were cool like me,
which I can only try to be,
you could have, you know, beatboxed your way, you know, into his heart at that moment. But
I can beatbox, and I do make him listen to old school hip hop, which is
you can beatbox. Is that what you just said?
Yeah.
Let's hear some.
I'm not ready. Some other time I'll beatbox for you. Not now. No.
All right. Well, I hope that answers your question, patron Elizabeth. I'm pretty sure you, if I remember right, actually are a behavioral therapist and know a lot more about this than I do. And if you're working with special needs kids and you're, you know, using various different reinforcers, I'm sure you have a very complicated system that, you know, is effective because you're an expert in that.
Can I say something else?
Sure.
That people might not understand that when somebody, depending on someone's IQ, they may never learn a behavior. So like when I was working with adults who had fetal alcohol syndrome, mm-hmm. you know, they may never learn that new behavior. A moment to moment, day to day, you're just constantly working on the bare basics. And it's really difficult work.
Right. Yeah, that's part of the definition of intelligence is the ability to learn. And for people who have some conditions, they don't learn. They don't learn from experience. And so shaping a behavior of someone who doesn't learn is nearly impossible. It's akin to, I mean, not, you know, to take it to a very far extreme. I remember when I was at some, you know, animal show, they were demonstrating the intelligence of the different animals. And for certain birds and cats and dogs, they were saying, you know, watch us as we shape behavior of these animals. And they did some kind of demonstration and showed, like, very quickly this animal could figure it out, you know, and would learn from experience. And then they brought an ostrich in front of the crowd. And I guess ostriches are really dumb and could not. And they did the same demonstration with these ostriches. Ostriches? Is that how you say ostrich?
Ostri? I don't know, actually, yeah. What the plural is.
Ostrosi. And they demonstrated that the ostrich could not learn. It just would not. It did not learn from... And with these other animals, they demonstrated it did learn with those and the ostrich. And again, humans are even the, you know, perhaps on the low end of the IQ are vastly, you know, more intelligent than an ostrich. But the point is that it's hard. And I feel so bad for professional and thank God that these people are working with these people because it's so hard work. I mean, the very limited experience I've had doing this kind of work, you know, I've worked with autistic spectrum kids in my early career. And I just remember thinking, I can't wait to get out of this situation, you know. I mean, there were moments, obviously, that were really fun and enjoyable. But there are just, it's just so fatiguing. You know, it's just... And the system puts so much pressure on the professionals to, like, get a job done, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've met dozens of what they call, you know, the behaviorally disabled class teachers, you know, these people?
Mm-hmm.
You know, in public schools, they, or I guess even private schools, they have classrooms sometimes where the quote-unquote behaviorally disabled kids go. What, you know, so these might be autistic spectrum kids, they might be abused kids, they might be FAE kids or something. And they, in regular classes, present so much problems that they get kind of put in this other class. And they require a very special kind of teacher. They don't give these kids to just any old, you know, history teacher or something. And universally... these teachers are crazy, but like in a good way, you know, they're the most, and of course I'm generalizing, but every one of them that I've met, I've just been like, wow, you are an out of the box thinker. They're so out of the box, and you have to work in those kind of environments because it's so challenging. It's sort of like my theory about people who are really good at running marathons. When I grew up, with a lot of runners. I'm terrible. I'm like, you know, a 100-yard dash by like by like yard 50, I was like, is this thing over yet? You know, but I knew a lot of people could just run forever. And they were the most serene, calm, low-key people on the planet. And I just had this theory, like, I wonder if, like, the fact that you're just so low-key allows you to just kind of drift as you run these marathons, you know? Whereas my brain is running a mile a minute, and as soon as I start running, I'm just like, okay, you know, what am I going to do next, you know? When's this thing going to be over? And I think that people who work with, you know, these behavior, quote unquote, behaviorally disabled kids have to be a particular kind of person. Have you had that experience?
Yeah. And I have done that work with adults. And actually it's art therapy is helpful in that because you can see how delayed they are in the art. Mm. And so it's a great reminder of like, oh, right, this person is really delayed because, you know, maybe they can do a ton of other things just fine, but like the five things you really need them to do, like manage their money, you know, stop losing their wallet, you know, they can't do. And so it's really hard work. It's really, really draining.
Yeah.
I do want to mention another animal that is difficult to train.
Yeah.
Which is the sunfish.
Oh. Random.
So if you're ever at the aquarium in Monterey, it's like one of the most amazing places on earth. They do this, they have this huge tank and they do all these similar to what you're talking about, like different examples of how to get the animals to move in response to food. And then they have this one gigantic sunfish, which is like this like animal from another time. And they put this giant ball in, which is red. And inside the ball is some yummy jello with the animal's favorite food. And they say like 50% of the time, the sunfish is like, oh, right. In that red ball is a thing that I like. And right. The other 50% of the time, does not remember. No right. clue.
Yeah. Why are sunfish shaped so it looks like... Why are they shaped like that? They're the
I
most,
don't know. They're huge. It's like... As if a flounder turned on its side and went swimming.
Yeah.
I mean, they're huge.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like how do they survive when they're basically just like walk? They're just like slowly lumping along, waiting for a predator to eat it. I don't understand. There's so many things in the sea I just don't understand. And that
they
that's,
must not be tasty. There must be some. There must the word must be out that they're. You know, lumpy and fleshy. They're not like salmon or tuna. You never get served like sunfish at a restaurant.
That's true.
I don't know. We got to do some research about this.
But maybe that's just the rumor they're spreading because they don't want... Maybe that's their key. They're terrible.
Maybe they smell bad. Maybe...
Yeah.
That's
maybe,
it.
Maybe... I mean, I've never smelled one. So, yeah, your theory is... I can't disprove it, right?
So it must be true.
Yeah.
That's how our current science, that's how our country is working right now, so.
Yeah. Oh, well, you know, goodbye environment. But anyway, that does it for that episode of Psychology in Seattle in which we meandered for a while. Thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because, why?
Someone's got to feed that sunfish.
Yeah, and if you don't take care of yourself, who's going to feed that sunfish?
Yeah.
That's another thing. If a sunfish is so non-intelligent, how does it survive?
Well, how does the ostrich is fast. We know that. And it's big.
Right. Right. So there you go. Like, you're not going to mess with an ostrich. And
right.
Good luck trying to catch one.
Right.
But sunfish is just, it's not intelligent, and it's slow and huge and noticeable. And
maybe
awkward.
It's not noticeable. Maybe the color of it is, it's got to have something going for it.
I know. Well, you know.
How does, I mean, maybe.
Well, here's the deal. You ask your son to ask the machine.
Right. I'm going to go up right now and ask Alexa, how does the sunfish keep predators away?
You realize every time you say that word, if someone's listening on their, like, you
it's
know,
like
it'll trigger their thing. Yeah.
1,000 Alexas are responding. Alexa, play hip hop 24-hour radio.
Alexa, why is a sunfish so dumb?
Okay. That thing. I don't know. It's very, when I have to say, the parental guilt is really intense. So people come over now and I have to tell the whole story. Like, my child has something in his room that we would never pay for, but it was a gift. Like, because otherwise I'm afraid people are going to walk in and be like, he has an Alexa? These people have money coming out of their ears. It's like, yeah. No.
Alexa, is Rebecca a bad parent for buying her son an Alexa?
It's like, I would never put that thing in my child's room. But who knew that you could listen to This American Life whenever you wanted to? I mean,
yeah, but my God, what a great, I mean, that's my dream. 24/7 This American Life. I mean, come on.
He loves it.
I love him. That's just, that is fantastic. He's going to grow up to be such a great person. I mean, if I had This American Life when I was his age, I could have skipped through a lot of, you know, mistakes in my.
But he is alternating it with the current misogynist hip hop.
Yeah, but it's a good antidote. You know what I mean? Well, like, you can't fit both those things in your head. Like, one of, you know, he's probably
one
like
one of them is going to win out.
Yeah. Well,
and
we'll
when
see.
I point out how misogynist it is, he says, well, that's just one person's opinion about one person that they were dating. It's like, I cannot believe we are having this conversation and I am losing.
Well, he's so far ahead of the game. I mean, he has a mom who is even talking about misogyny. I mean, man, you know, if he grows up to be a douchebag, it was not because...
It's not my fault.
No.
He's pre-programmed.
Yeah. Yeah.
We're going to blame it on logic if he's a total douchebag.
Well, you could blame it on Alexa. Well, that's fine.